Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Winners and Losers radio program here, a special edition here, taking place on Wednesday, the 25th of October. My name is John Case. Gail Becker is trying to get here. I hope he does get here. I don't know whether he will. He gets lost driving here, and so I'm not sure. What will happen with that? But yeah, I'm going to call a guest that we've scheduled this morning, and let me just get his information up here so we can get ready and get started. We're going to call him in about 5 minutes, assuming that I can figure out what I'm doing on the computer. But we are recording here this morning, and I'm just trying to get my microphone a little bit adjusted. Yes, there we go. Okay. All right. So the topic is going to be engaging the public to fight climate science deniers. Anyway, our guest is going to be Keith Alexander, and we're going to be calling him in a minute. Gail Becker has written up the subject matter today, how might literature, history, and other humanities be used to educate and engage the general public in the science of the environmental crisis. Keith Alexander, PhD of Sheppard University's History Department, will discuss plans for a new biennial symposium, Humanities in the 21st Century, on which Sheppard and the National Conservation and Training Center are collaborating. The initial two-day session later this week, titled Humanities in the Environment, will bring together writers, historians, filmmakers, and scientists to discuss the role of humanities in educating general audiences about our environmental challenges. All right. And that's what we're going to be hoping to talk to Dr. Keith Alexander, George Washington Institute of Living Ethics Scholar, Assistant Professor of History, Sheppard University. So, as soon as we get to the right time here, we'll sort of do that. In the meantime, welcome to enlightenradio.org. My name is John Case, and we're doing this program a little more occasionally than we used to. But anyway, I try to do it in a sequence in which I can get the interviews and discussions posted online and blog, which is you can always find at enlightenradio.org. And the podcasts are usually listed at podcasts.enlightenradio.org. Anyway, that's the essential news on that. So it's been an interesting discussion. Obviously, the controversy over science, its role, and what's to be believed and not to be believed, and how to get people to better understand the languages of science, or at least communicate the meaning. Meaning is what we're trying to get to, but a lot of times the barriers of understanding the terms in which specialized fields talk about the data they have and the hypotheses about their guesses, and then how do you test a guess to find out whether or not it's true or not, or valid, what constitutes validity. I think there's a lot of questions there that have a long history. People have tried lots of different angles on it, and there's, I think there's a pretty broad consensus among scientists who study the history of science as to, what methods tend to be more stronger than others. Understand that no method is absolutely perfect, because no knowledge is not absolute. But nonetheless, certain methods, reproducibility, certain logics, if you can handle your assumptions, then, understanding, what constitutes actually a logical, deduction versus one that may have a hole in it. That can help, to give you some idea of how certain your result may be. The value of statistical analysis, which many people misunderstand. Some people say, oh, gee, you can lie with statistics. Well, yes, you can shoot people with a gun. But it's people that shoot people, not guns. Yes, but you can also find out important truths with statistics. Then there is a science of statistics that allows you to discover real patterns and tendencies in large, and even some, and even sometimes well selected data sets. And we can learn a lot. We can learn an awful lot about what's really going on. So, and you can learn that one of the most important things is that appearance and reality are not the same thing in many cases. Okay, we're going to call Dr. Alexander now. Hold on here while I move my microphone around and do this here. I'm going to get up here, let's cancel that, and call, okay, we're going to call, 304. Eight 3 9 5 7 3 5. Let's see if we can make this work here.
Alexander.
Dr. Alexander, this is John Case calling from Enlightened Radio. How are you?
I'm fine. Good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Can you hear me okay?
I sure can. How about you on your end?
Yes, it's coming through pretty good.
Great.
We are recording, so we're on the air. Welcome to Enlightened Radio, Dr. Alexander. And so I was reading Gail Becker's, my good friend and co-host, who's trying to get here but has a hard time finding Bolivar, apparently. So we'll see
what
he makes it over to our studio. But anyway, he was telling me that you have engaged in a conference of sort, a symposium that called Humanities in the 21st Century, where you're trying to figure out ways in which different disciplines can help communicate the general public the science of the environmental crisis, right? And maybe other scientific issues as well. Maybe you can open up by telling me a little bit about that effort and why you're involved in it and what you hope to achieve.
Sure. So it's a two-day conference, as you noted. It's tomorrow and Friday, and it's going to be held out at the National Conservation Training Center right here in Shepherdstown. And the central goals are really twofold. So first of all, as you note, it's a communications goal. Scientists have long known that we have a problem, lots of different problems. An environmental crisis, and they have been able to go in great detail regarding these crises that we face. What they have not been able to do is reach out in a more effective way to the general public to get that general public to be engaged and to begin making a difference. That's the, sort of the first goal, is to encourage scientists to be able to communicate better to the general public. The second, and we certainly feel that the humanities can play a role there. The second goal would be really to bring the humanities to bear on this set of issues and to begin to inspire and sort of ratchet it up quite a few notches, because it's time. It's past time. And so we really need to get thinking about the ways in which the humanities disciplines, history, literature, photography, filmmaking, music, and so on, can begin to mobilize the public. There's a wonderful quote by a guy named Gus Speth. And Gus Speth is an environmental consultant. He's written quite a lot in the environmental field. And he wrote about how basically scientists have known that there is a problem. We've known this for a long time. He wrote, and this is a quote, "I used to think that top environmental problems were biodiversity loss, ecosystem collapse, and climate change. I thought that 30 years of good science could address these problems. I was wrong. The top environmental problems are selfishness, greed, and apathy. And with these, we need a cultural and spiritual transformation. And we scientists don't know how to do that." And that's the end of his quote. And so I see a major goal of this symposium to be bringing people together to think about this charge by James Speth.
Let me ask you on that subject here, that there's a famous scientist, his name is Daniel Kahneman, who I believe he was trained in originally in psychology, but he wrote a book not too long ago called Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow. And how the difference between what we might call scientific and other kinds of responses could be kind of categorized in the kind of things to which we would normally respond, oh, been there, done that, okay? An intuitive response, you know, to a certain term that you might not, that has a certain context that the person that you're talking to doesn't share, okay, and from your family or mm-hmm. from background or some kind. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And people respond quickly or intuitively, right? And that intuition is more wrong than right, was Kahneman's, one of his conclusions, right? And that this is the, that appearance and reality are not always the same. And that's why you need science. but so in a way, you're trying to communicate that, once you get people to recognize, okay, there is that kind of gap between, hey, I thought it was true, but is it really true? What are some of your thoughts on, what are some of how do you determine what works and what doesn't? What in your own mind, how do you measure? Do you have things you look at that say, oh, gee, that looks like that's working well. This looks like it's not communicating well. How do you think about that?
Well, sure. And I'm not familiar with that particular work. I can say that, I mean, this is the genius of science. Science is fantastic at telling us what is true and what is not. What is not been the strength of science is in communicating those discoveries necessarily. And so that has left room for sort of maybe intuition to jump in and, yeah. and fill the breach. And that intuition, as you note, is all too often either false or, you know, we're lazy. And so we don't maybe like the things that scientists are concluding. So we pretend to, we have to look the other way.
Right.
In terms of, determining what communication works well, I think, you know, there's a pretty straightforward test. I mean, does it inspire? Does it help people to understand the problem? And does it inspire people to act on it and act on it in a scientifically informed way?
You know, a century or a half century ago, there used to be, I mean, a whole bunch of mags around on the, like the, grocery store magazine lists, even in bookstores, popular mechanics, you know, all kinds of stuff that was popular science. And it was like a cottage industry a little bit that, you know, build your own TV sets and all these other things. Remember, there was just a ton of...
Absolutely.
It seemed that...
I grew up with some of those.
That doesn't seem to be... chemistry sets, you know, for Christmas, even though your mother hated what you did with them. I'm just thinking of things, right, that you're trying to encourage an interest in science.
Sure, and I think those things are still around. I think we also live in the age of the internet, of course, and that's a big kind of distraction. And when things are sort of in the virtual world, it's a little bit harder to go in there and manipulate things. Although, you know, I'm sitting here looking at this little Kano computer that my kids have, and so you know, the ability to kind of go in and tinker and figure out how you know, the computer works and how the computer thinks. So there is that sort of realm, that aspect of science communication, which I think is a really good thing. That has not transferred over, however, I would argue, into an awareness of our ecosystems, how they function. It's one thing to sort of figure out, you know, playing with an erector set or do a simple chemistry experiment, to figuring out how these incredibly complex systems work and how they are threatened by current and past events. We're entering the age of the Anthropocene, and where humans are shaping the planet, and it's extraordinarily difficult to get a handle on these things because they are complex. We need better science education. We need better public information. We need better training for the layperson if we're going to be informed citizens making really, really important choices down the road. And so I think that this symposium can begin to address this as well. We're getting people into the same room who wouldn't necessarily be communicating with each other under normal circumstances. So I think that's wonderful. We've got engineers coming in from Penn State, for example, who are also very interested in communicating scientific discoveries to the public. We also have some Appalachian writers coming in and some environmental historians interacting. So it's this sort of melting pot, this opportunity to interact not only these experts together, but also bringing in the general public and the ability for the public to come in, listen to them talk, but also to do these breakout sessions, one of which I'm leading, to talk more, sort of mingle and to exchange ideas back and forth. So it's a wonderful sort of reinvigoration of this sort of symposium model, which I'm pretty excited about.
By the way, in the history of science, I mean, is that a field that you've paid much attention to? I had a question coming out of it, in case you, I was giving you a way out of not commenting on it if you don't want to, but I was thinking that in the history of science, you see certain, you know, it appear, this appears my intuition, that the appearance of certain waves of discovery, right, and of scientific interest, you know, not always 100% clear exactly what's driving it at a particular time, although I've read lots of different theories. But, and then there's times when it recedes. Do you know, is there any historical wave theory that you...
I'm not a historian of science, and I'm not a subscriber to a sort of historical wave theory or a cyclical theory of history. I think history is a lot more complex than that. I think that there are certain things that good scientific progress and scientific developments are associated with. You need a strong sort of state support of science and a cultural appreciation of education. I mean, that's what the scientific revolution was all about. That's why Britain emerged as a leader, because of this cultural support for science. We need a cultural support for science, but also a cultural support for being able to communicate and respect those scientific discoveries. We've got brilliant scientists out there doing brilliant things, brilliant work, coming up with some disturbing conclusions that maybe don't jibe well with what we would like. We need to be able to have a culture in which we understand and appreciate and can put those to work. And part of the issue is scientists are not necessarily trained in communicating that, but part of that issue is also that we as a culture tend to bury our heads in the sand if it's inconvenient, yeah. To quote Al Gore.
Well, there is the matter of, you know, the language barriers. I mean, I mean, of course, you learn this immediately in computer science, which was, you know, my own sort of scientific background. But it's true, and many sciences, that the specialized languages that, including mathematical ones, you know, that are the kind of entry barriers to actually getting some of the concepts, right? That is a barrier that only, you know, a rising, you know, average level of education, it seems to me, can ultimately bridge. Although I'm sure there's lots of ways in which, you know, collaboration and communication could help. But I mean, you know, I mean, I have a hard time seeing how, you know, some of the conversations that take place at fairly high level in, we'll take something like economic theory, even, for example, right? Which, I mean, involves calculations and algorithms that are, you know, if you don't have any sense of what they are at all, you're going to have a hard time evaluating the truthiness, to use the Stephen Colbert's.
Sure.
Of what's going on. No, yeah, I don't know. How about that? Yeah.
No, I think you're right. I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, we have been neglecting public education, so I think that's part of it. Part of it is, you know, scientists writing for scientists rather than the general public. But we have the papers right here in Shepherdstown at the NCTC of the quintessential example of science and literary skills, shall we say, working hand in hand, and that is Rachel Carson. All right.
Oh, published, that's right.
1962, Silent Spring. So this particular work did an absolutely brilliant job of taking pretty complex science regarding pesticides and DDT in particular and their impact on the environment, and making them accessible, not only accessible to the general public, but somehow beautiful and incredibly appealing to the public, and you know, really sort of launching the environmental movement today. And her papers are over here at the NCTC, which makes it all the more appropriate to have Shepherdstown sort of hosting this. What I would love to see a sort of new movement where we could be a center for maybe an interdisciplinary examination of some of these issues, and not only just examining them, but communicating them. And that's what it's all about.
Oh, I think it's a wonderful effort, and anything that can help out. I was sometimes wondering how among faith communities handle this. I mean, I remember also back in the 60s that, you know, the science and religion debate took place at a high liberal level. I remember, I'm thinking mostly of my background in the Episcopal Church, okay, which had divisions, and it had a quite liberal wing of I would call them existential Christians of some sort. Anyway, and they wanted to have this conversation with science and religion all the time. They didn't really want to shut it down, right? But that faded a bit. It seems to have in a way. And is that an important conversation though to promote? Pope Francis seems to be helping.
Go ahead. Yeah, absolutely. And there have been some really interesting developments in the Catholic Church recently with this current Pope, certainly. One of the things that we're most excited about with this conference, we are featuring David Conover's film, I think it's Behold the Earth. And so it is going to be shown on, I believe, Thursday of the conference. So that gets at exactly this issue of this, link, the important role that communities of faith can play. Unfortunately, I think that a number of these communities have fallen prey to exactly the kinds of things that faith enumerates: selfishness, greed, and apathy. Communities of faith are not immune to these. So there's an important role to play, but I think a lot of these, I'm thinking of the larger evangelical, mega churches, perhaps, maybe need to do some examination. And it's there in the Bible too. I mean, we're looking at stewardship being laid out in the Bible. All right, stewardship of the earth, and that's an important consideration. And that's one of the things that we'll be looking at this symposium as well.
I think you're competing there a little bit with the gospel of prosperity, which just says, it's okay to be rich. Don't worry about that eye through the needle of the
exactly right.
The mustard seed. Yeah. Don't worry about that one.
Right.
It's okay to be rich. Okay, Jesus.
Right.
Joel Osteen comes to mind.
I don't know if they were talking about quite that filthy rich.
But who knows? Well, some of them might be hard to say, right? But anyway.
Right.
Yeah, on another angle, for example, you have some, who's the British atheist, Richard, wrote The Ancestor's Tale, he's a great, there are some who are, let's call them militant atheists, okay?
Richard Dawkins,
yes, that's right. Right, like for Richard Dawkins, for example, who spends a good part of his time ridiculing the anti-scientific prejudices of religion and some other, things, and making them look, stupid. And he's actually, fairly adroit at it, but I mean, he's kind of clever at it sometimes, and he writes interesting books, and he's a competent scientist. His book, The Ancestor's Tale, is just magnificent. But on the other hand, it doesn't seem to be the most effective method of debating the matter in public square. I'm not sure. Although I guess all points of view, being heard is part of
creating constant anger isn't going to do a lot.
That's Gail talking here, by the way. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think at this point it's an all hands on deck situation. I don't think we can afford to eliminate other people from this discussion. I don't think we can afford to alienate communities of faith. I think that we are at this point at a bit of a crossroads where we need to decide if we're going to be working for the survival of this planet and for human civilization or not. And we need everybody, including communities of faith, perhaps especially communities of faith. And so there's certainly a role for them. And Richard Dawkins and other proponents of a purely scientific perspective certainly have a role to play as well.
Right.
But we can't afford to
make that, yeah.
listen to each other. We can't afford to alienate each other at this point. We need to focus on what we have in common, and there is enough of that certainly to unite us if we can allow that to happen. If we can let it.
And I had a good friend who was a I met many years ago. So too far back to even talk about in the midst of the civil rights movement in the 60s, and you know, she became an Episcopal priest later in life, and you know, she would often say that in defense of her scientific background, because she had a scientific background in her family and everything like that, she'd often say that I think it's our job to understand as much of the mystery as possible.
I like it.
And, you know, I thought that was but that it would remain a fundamental mystery, you know, to her was fine, you know, but that she had a, you know, no problem whatsoever. She had a comfortable spot there in trying to learn more about, you know, the universe and appreciate, and she took the time to get some scientific education. So mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. Now that's, you know, it's hard not to come back to that, to try and get people to do, by the time they finish high school, to if they finish. I've been reading some alarming statistics, by the way, on comparative levels of education completion by the workforces of the United States compared with other countries, going back to 1950 compared with 2010, and it's just mm-hmm. it's just a staggering change. Mm-hmm. Okay, so mm-hmm. We're not leading in many categories anymore.
No, I'm afraid we've really sort of ceded the field. Yeah,
it's a bit alarming. Well, so listen, following up from a symposium like this, do you have a book in mind or something?
There are a couple things that are going to emerge. First of all, we are, for those who cannot attend in person, registration is still ongoing. It's encouraged to have people register in advance. You can do that online. If you go to Shepherd's website and then look at the symposium, is right there on our main page, including a registration link. And there is a schedule there that indicates what programs will be live streamed, because they are live streaming it on Facebook. So those will be also then available later for people to access, because Facebook keeps that stuff. And then we will also be publishing the proceedings probably next year. So there will be something that people can walk away with as well there.
Well, I think
registration is ongoing and free and open to the public, and hope to see many, many people out there.
All right. It sounds like a great event. And I want to thank you very much for, you know, introducing it for us and for the conversation. And I'll get this posted up today online and send you a link to it in case you want to, you know,
great.
Send your friends or your enemies.
Absolutely. And I'll link to it on our website, too.
So. Okay. All right, my friend. Thank you so much for calling in. Take care of yourself.
Thanks so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. My pleasure. Yeah. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Hey, Gail. How you doing, buddy?
Okay, I think.
So you found
me. Other than getting,
you found your way here finally.
Turning the wrong way again.
Oh, man. Yeah, I'm so sorry.
One of these days I'm going to get it right. Okay.
Anyway, it's good to see you again. And anyway.
Yeah, long. I had with my wife, Margaret, we had a nice reunion with her family in England and Ireland, and we were there for about a month.
So I see you head over there to Ireland, and then pretty soon a hurricane for the first time in known history goes to Ireland.
Oh my.
That wasn't something you brought with you. Hey, Becker is going to Ireland. We'll send a hurricane along and kick him in the butt.
Now, actually, it was nice while we were there, but yeah. Talk about hurricanes. I mean, there was you may have seen in the Atlantic online this morning, they did a story about that a new survey among, or new study, really, a better term for it, among by some prominent scientists, shows that flooding due to climate change could hit New York every 5 years. And this, you know, this is a...
look how many.
A good argument, I think, for the symposium that that Keith and others are organizing.
Right. No, it's well. Look how many of the major U.S. cities are on the ocean.
Oh my!
Or big bodies of water. Okay, so I mean, you got the Great Lakes, Chicago. You got the West Coast cities. You got the East Coast cities. You got most of the Gulf cities. You know, I mean, come on. What do you got? You're gonna have to move to Kansas City, Missouri to.
Yeah, well,
flooded.
I think it startled some people that. Perhaps more to the right when it was brought out 6 months, a year ago, that some of the military bases were actually being threatened. Man, when our firearms gets threatened, then things are bad. Okay,
whatever gets you to the horse trough here.
Yeah.
I suppose we'll if that's what wakes you up. Hey, they're going to take my guns. Oh my God. Okay. All right. Well, listen. So do we want to just podcast this one today and like this? And I like doing them shorter on the because people listen to them better when they're shorter. They don't
okay.
listen.
Yeah, okay,
if we
sure.
go on for two, it's, you know. Sure. All right. So I'm gonna cut off the podcast right now. And you've been listening to the Winners and Losers Radio Show. We're doing this sort of a little more occasionally now, and as podcasts mostly. And for the rest of the day, Stuart Acuff was going to have a show this morning, but guess what? Here he is. He is actually conducting a big training program for a region of the United Auto Workers up in Michigan this week,
oh.
and he got himself a paid gig. Go,
okay.
Stuart. Okay, and get your deal going up there. That's good.
Good
a little
for,
extra retirement good for income and yeah. trip to Michigan to see some auto workers too. That'd be fun. Good luck to you. Okay, on that. So we're not going to do that this morning, but anyway. And well, Gail, you doing okay? You hanging in there, buddy?
I think so. Did you mention this morning the Republicans with the vote of the vice president were able to push through a resolution last night that'll severely weaken the consumer's rights to
You can't sue anymore. I saw that. We covered that on our new little early morning program here. We have with Mike Diesel called the Moose Turd Cafe.
That. Okay.
Yes, we got that one. Yeah, we got that one today.
So
we nailed that one.
Okay.
We
that so one. Mike had a few things to say about.
No, that. We all did. Yeah, we had. We had to explain banking.
So
the conclusion of that, by the way, is that as Bertolt Brecht says, you know, compare the crime of a bank robber to the crime of the founding of a bank.
Yeah.
And then, of course, my great mentor, Dom Tormey's explanation of banking, which he gave at a shop stewards class in about 1973, or maybe four, to us. And he says, banking, that's where the bank agrees to save your money for you and return to you a high interest rate of 2% and then loan it back to you at the low interest rate of 18%.
Right.
That's the description of banking right there. Okay, so that was we covered that this morning anyway. But all right, let's cut off this podcast now, and so folks can they don't have to spend all morning listening to us.